following is a presentation from your friends at Forcecast.net.
It's the Forcecast.
Home to the official podcast of TheForce.net.
I feel the Force.
And RebelScum.com.
You Rebel Scum.
Here they come!
This is the Forcecast Clone Wars Roundtable.
You fought in the Clone Wars?
Information, commentary, and discussion about Star Wars The Clone Wars.
This is where the fun begins.
In laser clickers!
Now, the Forcecast Clone Wars Roundtable.
Anakin, Rex, Cody, pull back! All troops, pull back! It's the Forcecast Clone Wars Roundtable. I have a bad feeling about this.
Begun. The Clone War has...
Incoming!
All batteries return fire.
Go, go, go!
All right, and a long overdue welcome back to the Forcecast Clone Wars Roundtable, where we analyze, dissect, pick apart, and otherwise natter, as our good buddy Paul Bateman would say, about Star Wars The Clone Wars. We've got a great panel to talk about. Three episodes this week. That's right, we're going to cover the entire Night Sisters trilogy of episodes. We discussed this on the regular Forcecast a couple of weeks ago, how best to tackle these, and we decided that it'd be best just to wait till everybody's seen all three episodes. Because we like to speculate, and what's the fun of speculating if, you know, Jimmy's seen the other two episodes or the other episode, and Kyle's seen it, and Paul and I haven't, whatever. And I guess I gave away the panel. We got an amazing panel here. It's one of my favorite panels that we're able to assemble. We can get them together. And it's been a while since we've had them together. But first, my good friend and yours, Jimmy Mack. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Jason. Hey, Star Wars fans. This will be a day long remembered. Yes, the Clone Wars Roundtable returns with our much anticipated analysis and discussion of the Night Sisters trilogy. You know, almost 2 months, two freaking months have passed since I saw this episode at a most amazing screening in downtown Chicago. And it's been hard, man, to keep quiet all this time. But our day has come. And tonight, the silence will be broken with our dissection of the origin of Savage Opress, the return of Asajj Ventress, and a new era for Star Wars The Clone Wars with the Night Sisters Trilogy.
Yes, cannot wait. Also joining us this week from the UK, you can find him at RalphMacquarie.com, our good buddy. He stays up late with us, and we appreciate it oh so much. Paul Bateman, welcome back, Paul.
Hey, guys. Hey, everybody. Great to be here again, even though it's crazy, crazy late in the morning.
And last,
but, always great fun to be here.
Is Athena up or did no? She's
oh no, there. She yeah. She crushed it hours ago.
She knew Kyle was going to be here, right?
Well, she might have stayed up especially for that, but yeah, she just couldn't stay awake any longer.
That's right. We've got him here, the director of Fanboys and a good friend of ours here, Kyle Newman. Kyle, welcome back to the roundtable.
I am so glad to be here. Thank you, guys. There's no better place I'd rather be than with the three of you talking Star Wars, since we pretty much do it every day, but via email.
Yeah, it's nice to actually do it on the Skype or whatever. All right, let's get into it. We're talking about three episodes. They are Night Sisters, Monster, and Witches of the Mist, episodes number 56 through 58. All three written by Katie Lucas, of course, the daughter of Star Wars creator George Lucas. The the first and the third, Night Sisters and Witches of the Mist, directed by Giancarlo Volpe, and Monster, the one in between there, directed by Kyle Dunleavy. And let's get right into it. What we're going to do, guys, I think is what's probably going to make this easiest is if we kind of look at it as all one story. Of course, Kyle, you and Jimmy, you guys experienced this all as one story. Were you, Kyle, watching these episodes individually as they ran each week?
Yeah, I also watched them individually because I was curious as to exactly where they broke it up. You could kind of sense it when you watched them on the big screen. But also, there's a couple of spots where they could have done their transition. So I was curious as to how they would do that breakdown. And I think, I feel like almost when I watched them when they aired live, they felt like they ended a little short, didn't they?
Yeah. You just felt like, wow, it's over already. Yeah, I felt the same way, Kyle, the exact same way.
And I think that's the one thing when I watched it, and I think we talked about this, Jimmy, right afterwards, it felt like we left the theater And maybe we talked that night or the next day, and I was like, you know what? I could watch so much more of the story. It felt like it was the most truncated version. Like, it could have been a five-parter for sure. Even the last episode could have been two parts, you know? So I think it was such rich material. There was so much, you know, character development. There's new characters, and they really take a character on a really good arc. So you felt like there could have been so much more to explore. So, but it had a nice pace to it, watching it all as one big film.
Yeah, I have to say that I was pretty envious of you guys, not just the fact that you saw it, you know, in an advanced way, but that you got to see it all together, because it really did feel some of the endings felt a little, I don't know if awkward's the right word, but like
abrupt.
Abrupt. Yeah, that's the perfect word. Paul, you experienced this kind of in real time along with me. What were your feelings on it? Were you also kind of wishing that you could have seen this all together, or how did you experience these three episodes?
Definitely. I was really impatient to see all three at once. So I think that was almost certainly the best way to watch it, I think, seeing all three together. But then I've always kind of thought that every single episode of The Clone Wars feels like it's at least half an hour long. I think it's very rare that I actually kind of feel like, yeah, that was a 20-minute show. Never feels like a 20-minute show to me. But yeah, the plotting was so concise, and there was zero dead wood, and it just moved along at such a pace that you kind of thought, oh, you know, I want to see all three parts right now. I don't have to wait a week to see the second part. But
yeah. I mean, that was, for me, that was really, really refreshing, because, I mean, you know, there were some episodes this season where I was like, please, please tell me that next week is not a continuation of this. This was totally the opposite thing. I couldn't wait for Friday night to roll along for this specific, you know, reason to watch The Clone Wars. I mean, I'm always, you know, relatively excited to see The Clone Wars, but, you know, it was as folks that have been listening to this roundtable know, for me, it was really starting to drag a little bit. And, but this was talk about a cleansing of the palate. I mean, these episodes really, really, really were, I called it saga changers. I mean, they really are. What did we learn? One of the big things that we learned is the breakdown between Asajj Ventress and Count Dooku. This is what we see. We see this happen. And what instigates it is Palpatine. Palpatine discovers, or wakes up one morning, I guess, and feels that Asajj Ventress is too strong. And whenever you've got the master apprentice and the apprentice is getting too strong and you got three of these Sith hanging around, one of them's got to go. And of course, it's not going to be Sidious Palpatine. So he talks to Dooku about offing Ventress. And, you know, it's kind of like a breakup. You know, Jimmy, I mean, you see these characters, and I mean, there's from the moment that Palpatine gives the order, Sidious gives the order, you can tell that there's a lot of reluctance on Dooku's part to do this, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely, because he's invested so much time in training her, you know, under the guise of being an assassin. What he's hiding from Palpatine, and this is natural for the Sith, because we know, you know, the Sith, always two there are, master and apprentice. But we also know that sooner or later, the apprentice is going to try to overthrow the master. Thus, Dooku planning ahead, you know, he's playing his own chess game, just like Sidious is so capable of doing. Dooku's doing his own behind-the-scenes work, and he's training this girl to become his apprentice for the time when he eventually wants to stab Sidious in his sleep, or however he wants to go about doing it. Yet, the fear of Sidious is still so great that the instant Sidious suggests that Dooku should kill off this assassin, Dooku does it. And yes, I mean, obviously, with a sense of reluctance, but he still does not hesitate. He carries out his master's will the first opportunity he gets, and in a very ruthless, cold fashion. That's what I liked about these episodes, is that you actually saw Dooku being the Sith Lord that he is. Prior to this episode, in previous episodes of The Clone Wars, we've mostly seen him in the guise of a politician and a separatist leader. But this time we see him not only acting as a Sith Lord, but actually giving us insight into what make the Sith tick. And clearly compassion is not part of the game. And also displaying a Jedi trait neither is attachment. Because Dooku cuts the cord from Asajj, you know, on just a moment's notice, on the mere suggestion by his Sith Lord Master Sidious that he should get rid of her, he gets rid of her. So he shows lack of compassion, lack of attachment, and loyalty to the Sith Master Sidious.
Well, I actually would say that it's not loyalty. I would say it's fear, because I think if he would have fought Sidious on this, then Sidious would have, I'm certain, would have off Dooku, would have made the same proposal to Ventress. And to get Dooku out. And it's interesting because there's a little bit of a change in the order of things. I mean, what we've seen is a history of going after the younger apprentice, the stronger, the younger, in the case of Sidious courting Anakin, and then we later see him as the Emperor courting Luke and leapfrogging Vader. In this case, he's wanting to off the apprentice. And Kyle, I was thinking that, you know, one of the things that, you know, fans of, you know, the Knights of the Old Republic and in some of these earlier eras of the Star Wars saga love are Legion of Sith. And then all of a sudden the Rule of Two comes along and you can't really have a whole lot of Sith. But maybe this is a way around it, right? You know, because if what we're seeing is if they get too powerful, the apprentice has to go. That could keep a chain. I mean, how many have we seen? Now we've seen Maul, we've seen Asajj Ventress, we've seen Dooku, we've seen Vader, we see we see Luke potentially. So maybe that's a way that you can actually grow the Sith Order, I guess. And Maul's not even dead. We'll talk about that in a minute.
I mean, there's always a volatility to the Sith, and I think that they even established that, you know, in the, you know, the original trilogy, in the way, you know, Vader's got an eye on his ultimate power and who can he, you know, draw to his side to achieve his goal of being the top of the food chain. But I think it is interesting, you know, that this is George territory. This is stuff he's created, you know, and set the groundwork for, that it's okay to have your little side, your side Sith, you know, your junior. And, you know, it gets to a point where, yes, if it threatens, and it's probably part of the test, you know, it's probably part of Sidious's test is to, you know, let him do that and let him get a sense and then also bring him down and take him out and say, you can't have that anymore. It's a power play too. And obviously Sidious still feels very comfortable that he is in a position of power and he still has enough knowledge that he's retained that he hasn't shared with his, you know, with his second in command, that he's, you know, he's got him on the string. He's not gonna, you know, cut cord and say screw you. Because obviously he doesn't think Ventress is ready. I think if Dooku felt Ventress was absolutely ready, which she's not, and which these episodes in a way prove, then Dooku may have made his move. But I do think it's interesting that they're allowed to keep that you know, that dark Jedi or whatever you want to call it in their pocket, their assassin. To do this type of missions. But, I mean, maybe at one point we'll find out that Sidious has something on the side as well.
Well, I think the difference is that Sidious, you know, I mean, it's interesting when you think about Sidious being approving of Dooku having his own apprentice, because obviously there's that Sith paranoia and the whole Rule of Two and all of that. But Sidious is in an interesting position, Paul, because he's in hiding. He can't be out there working actively with Dooku like you know, a typical master-apprentice relationship would be. They'd be maybe in battle together, doing things together. I mean, he's in hiding. So in a sense, he has to kind of forego his, you know, some of this reluctance for Dooku to have his own apprentice, because he can't be out there on the front lines with him.
Yeah, I think one of the things about the way that Palpatine seems to be playing this is that it does feel very kind of chess-like, in that I don't think he necessarily would have cared if Dooku had been defeated by Asajj. I think it's a numbers game for him. I feel as though it was almost as though he was kind of potentially even sizing Asajj up as a replacement for Dooku, because I mean Dooku's getting older, know, maybe he was thinking she was another possibility, and a good way to kind of, you know, keep control over it is to just, you know, make sure one of them finishes up on the floor, and then he just kind of picks up the pieces later on. So I think for him it's just about controlling the numbers, and he's I don't think he necessarily cares which one of them would win.
Ah, that's a good point. So when he lays it out there for Dooku that he needs to get rid of Ventress, he's kind of he's thinking, well, you know, one of them will survive this, and that'll be the one. That's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. I guess I was looking at it more like it was a choice that Sidious was choosing. That Dooku's the one, and Ventress is just in the way at this point. But Ventress's character really gets filled out here in this episode. I mean, I, of all the characters that we've been introduced in the Clone Wars, she's the one that I would say, in my estimation, I was least likely to believe that I would have some compassion for. And I really have... I don't know. I see her totally differently now. That's why I say this really is saga changing. When they talk about secrets revealed, I mean, she's an orphan. How many times? How many times is she, orphaned? Want to go to the, it's courtesy of StarWars.com, of course, the episode guide where they talk about this, fill in some of the names. It says, for the Clone Wars series, writer Katie Lucas preserved much of this EU backstory. Now, they were talking about the EU backstory of Ventress, which a lot of this is goes back to concept work for the prequel films and a backstory written by Hayden Blackman for Dark Horse. But what's interesting about the way they phrase this in the episode guide is they say, for this authoritative depiction of Asajj and her history. So here you got the episode guide coming out and saying, all right, you've read the EU, you've read done this. Okay, this is the authoritative depiction of Asajj and her history. And in these flashbacks that we see in this episode, young Asajj is handed over by her Dathomirian mother to a Sinatine criminal named Halstead. And I wasn't sure if this guy was like a pirate or if this guy was... a bounty hunter. I don't know. They're calling him a criminal. Then flashbacks move to Ratatak, where she's discovered by Kai Narek after Halstead dies on an assault by Weequay janitors. I mean, Weequay raiders. But
you can't help yourself.
But I mean, when you think about this, I mean, that scene is heartbreaking, Jimmy, when they're pulling her away from her natural mother on Dathomir. And so then you see her obviously having established a bond to her new, to her master, this criminal. And then he gets killed. And then she has this bond to Kai Narek. And then he gets killed. And then she ends up with Dooku. And Dooku doesn't die, but he betrays her. I mean, this is a tragic, tragic character.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, perfect for manipulation by the dark side. And I recommend longtime Star Wars comic readers to dig through your long box and dig up Star Wars Republic issue number 60. And this is the Hayden Blackman story, The Origin of Asajj Ventress. Highly recommend. You'll see there are many parallels to the episode Night Sisters and the, I guess we're going to say the bottom line, the absolute... What is their exact wording? The origin of Asajj.
Yeah, the authoritative depiction
authoritative,
here.
Thank you. Yeah. The authoritative origin of Asajj, but you'll see several parallels. You'll see the Kai Narek character. You'll see her being removed from her family. But it's not the Night Sisters. And you mentioned getting taken away from her mother. Who was her mother? Was it Mother Talzin? I'm not sure. But there are some
similarities. No, it wasn't. You know what? Jim, I'm glad you brought that up because it took me three times to catch this because I was wondering when she was talking to Mother Talzin, was she calling her mother out of that's her position of respect, authority, etc., or was it really her mother? And in that flashback sequence, you do see Talzin there as Ventress is being handed over to this criminal to, for whatever reason, they call it to save the clan. Yeah,
man, and we don't know why. We don't know why this, you know, the sacrifice this specific child would protect the Night Sisters clan. That's a mystery right there.
Yeah.
So there's still more to Asajj's story to be told, I'm sure. But you do see in this script for Night Sisters, there is definitely a nod to existing EU. And not only that, but to the Clone Wars micro series, the Tartakovsky series. You'll mm-hmm. see there's similarities there with her training by the dark side and everything. And then you saw that again repeated with the training of Savage Opress, which sort of mirrored when Dooku was training Grievous on lightsaber usage.
Right.
I mean, yeah. there's similarities there. You know, I found those two sequences to be very similar. The Tartakovsky Dooku training Grievous compared to the Clone Wars Dooku training Savage. So I recommend you go dig up that issue of Star Wars Republic number 60, and you'll see that they did remain faithful to that existing EU material. Yet, still questions begging to be asked, but clarification of other issues as well. So that, doesn't Star Wars do that better than any other franchise? For as many stones they turn over, they turn them back over, and you know, it's just every
more question. More questions.
Every answer promotes more questions, and it goes on and on and on.
Kyle, one of the things we talk about here on the roundtable is growth of characters, and there was a moment in that battle, in that duel between Asajj Ventress, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Anakin. She puts them in a chokehold, and there's no escape for those guys. She bests Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's only when the space battle hits that she's distracted and she loses her concentration. Did Asajj Ventress essentially win that battle?
Well, I think there's been so many instances where, you know, heroes are fortuitous and situation allows them to escape. And that's for dramatic purpose. I mean, obviously, yeah, she had the upper hand there. But who knows? Anakin is a pretty resourceful, and he's also at this point probably the most powerful force user in the galaxy, although it's, you know, unrefined and not completely harnessed. So I'm sure he would have found a way out of it. But yeah, she really held her own there against two Jedis, especially after, you know, being injured. And talking about character, you know, one of the things I loved about this episode was it wasn't just, you know, three parts and the bad guys are the bad guys. And I think we all, you know, there's been talk online about how Savage Opress, you know, he starts in a very I'm calling him Savage, by the way. I'm not French. He starts in a very you know, we understand him in a human, or shall I say, Zabrak or whatever he is way. He's looking out for a peer of his. It's like there is that brotherly connection, and there's you know, that humanity that grounds him and lets us understand him, and we kind of feel like him, and he's manipulated, and he's brought into this thing unwillingly, and he becomes a monster. You know, there is that transformation, but at the same time, what I loved about this episode was we weren't just getting like another side to an antagonist, but we were getting another side to Ventress too, and you know, that's what gave this trilogy real depth, is that we were seeing two sides of what is traditionally, you know, each antagonist, and they did that in a very well. It balanced each other. You know, you're seeing a duality in Ventress that was kind of refreshing. You're seeing all these things. Like she's used to loss. She's accustomed to being alone and being let down by the circumstances of the galaxy. And you see it happening again. You see it in her past, and we also see it happening again right at the beginning of the episode. She's just dropped, you know?
Yeah.
And
Kyle, let me ask you, at any point during this series, did you think that Asajj Ventress was a former Jedi?
No, but I nor has there been, you know, any time where I was supposed to know that.
Right. I mean, that was a huge reveal for me. That was a huge secret reveal. I had no idea she was actually a Padawan.
That was a big reveal, and that was a secret reveal. And I think that's what's exciting about it, is we as fans take so much for granted. What we want to do, what a human mind does, is it logically, you see, you know, point A and point C, so we naturally want to fill in point B the way we want to see it. And that's what we've had to do as Star Wars fans for 34 years. We know, okay, well, we know that something happens because of what we found out in Starlog and what we heard in just passing dialogue in A New Hope, what's going to happen in the prequels. And then we went and made up our minds about the prequels 20 years before we even saw them. You know, and that's what we do here. In a smaller microcosmic level, we take Ventress and we're like, well, here we know who Ventress is, and she's she's a lethal assassin and she's cold-hearted. So we automatically assume, you know, everything, we know everything about her. And what I love about the show is it's allowing them to texture and shade it the way George wants to do it. This is, you know, George's universe again. And what basically Ventress did was, you know, she came from, you know, I don't know what we'd call that original series, if it's EU or not, or TU or whatever people are calling it these days. But she came from that and graduated into the major leagues, you know, and this is George's way of telling that story, or more specifically, you know, Katie's way of really mm-hmm. texturing that story, but it's based on his grand design.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think as fans, we are very accustomed to just kind of filling the gap, and that's just yeah. the way a human mind works. So I thought that was great. I was surprised. I was like, oh, I never knew that. And but they still found a way to tie it into as best they can, you know, with reverence towards what's been established and what's out there. So they did that again with, you know, with Darth Maul's origin and the way they discuss it in these episodes. And I think they, you know, and what they did with Oppress, you know, was create a very interesting genesis for a character, which yeah. wasn't, I'm a nasty guy, and they picked the most nasty guy to be.
Well,
the villain,
of all the characters, obvious. Of all the characters, I have the most notes about Oppress. So we'll hold that thought. We'll come back
okay,
to Oppress.
Yeah. So Ventress, I think I was totally surprised. So yeah, I didn't know that before.
Yeah, Paul, where do you think she goes at the end? I mean, she's like the terminal orphan.
Well, the first thing that I noticed was that. Being as we were just talking about the sword fight between her and the Anakin and Obi-Wan, was that I think an important point that's been missed in this discussion is the fact that she was wearing a dress. She still managed to beat them up. So, like, what I'd like to know is if Obi-Wan and Anakin were both wearing dresses, would she have beaten them up even quicker? I think it's inevitable. I think she's just proven how tough she is because, you know, if she can be kind of wearing casual evening attire and still manage to
quote that Ginger Rogers once said? Of course, the famous dance partner Fred Astaire, I did everything Fred did, but backwards and in high heels. Asajj Ventress exactly. is doing everything that Anakin and Obi-Wan have done, but wearing that dress. Of course, that dress, interestingly enough, is harkens back to some of the original concept art when she was originally going to be a character. I think it was episode 2. It was a design before they went with Dooku.
Original sketches, wasn't it? Yeah. Dooku power.
So very cool.
To get back to the serious stuff, uh-huh. I guess the thing that really amazed me about all three of these episodes is that, for me, I think this is the first time that I've actually kind of been very conscious of the fact that I've suddenly kind of feel as though all the characters have the same weight. Even the what we may have originally considered secondary characters like Asajj and Ahsoka, they now to me have the same weight as any of the characters that were in the movies. In fact, it kind of feels strange to think that Asajj and Ahsoka weren't in the films.
It does, doesn't it? It does. You're right.
So, I mean, it just shows what a great job they're doing. And, I mean, another thing that I noticed that I thought was quite significant that clicked into place for me in these episodes, which I now acknowledge that I like Obi-Wan and Anakin as much as I used to like Han and Luke, which for me is a bit of a breakthrough because I really did not think that I would get taken there. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of those characters in the prequel trilogy. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, thanks to 3 seasons of The Clone Wars, I feel like it's taken me to a place where I like those characters every bit as much as the original trilogy characters. So
I agree. I have I thought that in that third episode we saw some amazing chemistry between, of course, voice actors James Arnold Taylor and Matt Lanter, and just really good dialogue. Finally, you know, I mean, now The Clone Wars has given us good Anakin and Obi-Wan dialogue before, but kind of going back to the prequels, I mean, it's great in The Clone Wars, and it was really on display in this in these episodes. Great dialogue. They really understood the characters, and it felt natural, and there was kind of a competitive yet respectful. I mean, it just got it right. In this, I really, really, I'm glad you brought that up, Paul, because I wanted to mention that as well. I thought that they just did an awesome job with those characters. And I kind of, after that, I was like, oh, I want to see more. I want to see more Anakin Obi-Wan stuff.
Definitely.
Because they're really getting into their own. Let's talk about Dooku. I mean, we learn a lot about Ventress. We learn a lot about Dooku here. Jimmy, I was saying earlier that I really believed that, and you kind of went over it. I don't know if you knew where I was getting at, but I think that Dooku grieves for Ventress. There's that moment after he believes that she's dead and he's kind of sitting in his chamber and he's got to communicate with Palpatine and give him the confirmation, yes, she's dead. And there's that look. I interpreted that look as grief. What do you interpret that as?
Like, it could be, he's mourning the loss, not of necessarily Ventress, the individual, but mourning the loss of a relatively capable tool in his arsenal, something that he's spent a lot of time working on, refining, and getting to a point where he could count on her. But yet, when he did let her know that he was cutting ties with her, he said, "You failed me for the last time." Very similar to what Darth Vader said to Admiral Ozzel. Ozzel was a goof, as we all assume. And I would not put Asajj Ventress with all her powers in the same category as Admiral Ozzel, but yet it was the same level of just that dismissive nature where I'm just, I don't care about you. You're nothing more than just a piece of my arsenal, weapon in my arsenal. You're not an individual. You mean nothing to me. And I don't care what happens to you from this point forward. He's just cutting her loose. So I think that he was upset that he lost something that he invested in, that he had spent a lot of time working on, refining, and spending time on. The other thing I think he was upset about was the fact that he's still getting pushed around by Darth Sidious. The same way that he is dismissive of Asajj, Sidious is dismissive of him. Also, he might have been feeling like, wow, I just cut her loose and it was pretty simple and easy. And, my hands are clean. I've washed my hands of her. When is Sidious going to do the same to me? Maybe he was feeling something in the Force, maybe a vision of the future telling him that this could happen to him at the hands of Darth Sidious, which we all know does at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith. So it could be, a number of things. Jason, you said I was dismissive, but I'm going right back to the same thing I said before. I don't believe he felt any compassion for her. And the loyalty he showed to Darth Sidious, yes, was based in fear, but he was following the company line at that time. And Darth Sidious acknowledged him as being, once again, you've proven your loyalty to me. Exact words out of Darth Sidious. That was the perception Dooku wanted to portray to Darth Sidious. A, out of fear, and B, there might have been a modicum of loyalty there. Based in fear, obviously, because he knew what he just did to Ventress, quick and easy, can happen to him. And it does.
Kyle, the subtitle for this season is Secrets Revealed. And I mean, we've seen a lot of secrets revealed already. Probably the biggest one that I think we've seen so far is that Sith Lords sleep in their socks. And I don't know in their fuzzy black socks.
He needs to, because his castle is so Spartan, always drafty. So he needs his
bed socks. He needs his bed.
Are they silk or fleece pajamas? That's all I want to know.
They got the. They're like typical dude pajamas.
And when are they going to be available in StarWarsShop.com?
Oh, I want Dooku pajamas.
And how about the word monogram?
You know what? This is my secret. This is my ticket into the 501st. All I have to do is get a pair of black pajamas, get the beard, get the hair, going. I don't have to have a fancy costume or not, just a pair of black pajamas and black footies. And I'm there. I'm in. No. Dooku, Jimmy's talking about, that Dooku isn't so much mourning Asajj, he's mourning the opportunity, perhaps, to take Sidious out. But now that his apprentice is gone, he's kind of back to square one. This is maybe it's mourning his setback, more or less. But my question is, do you think that, this is for Kyle, do you think that the Sith have the same kind of connection to each other that the Jedi do? I mean, why why doesn't Dooku, why can't he sense that she's still alive? Or does he know the whole time that she's still out there?
No, and I don't believe he knows the whole time, but I also don't think that it's like this absolute power you're automatically tapped into. I mean, remember we discussed this way back on an episode where young Boba Fett walks by Mace Windu in a hallway. And it's not always your job to be dialed into immediately everyone around you. Dooku is also trained first as a Jedi, so there's maybe his manners apply in that sense, where he's not just reaching out into everything. I don't know. I didn't take that as a weird beat. I think there was a massive explosion. He was told she's dead, so there was really no need to continue to ponder it or spend his energy, you know, sensing deep into the Force, you know, planets away, what happened to her. You know, and I think if he sat down and meditated and spent that time, if it was in question, I'm sure he could look into it and find her. I don't think it has anything to do with the sensitivity of a Jedi versus a Sith.
Remember, Yoda said that the dark side clouds everything. Perhaps that could be also a very valid point, even among the Sith themselves.
True. I mean, I think this is, for me, it just felt like a point that, you know, there was no need to. She assumes she's dead, and that's it. It wasn't. Nor did he hear from Sidious, nor did he sense that she was still alive. It was like they took it at face value. If there was speculation, I'm sure they could have looked into it and found that. Yeah, you think he would have a high connection with her, and maybe he would sense the death, the moment of death. And when he didn't, he could have questioned it. But to me, it didn't bother me. And
Kyle, you brought up something very interesting, and I mean, I think that. You said perhaps he still has some of those – see, he lives a little bit by that Jedi code where you're not always invading someone's consciousness or whatever, that some of those instincts – I mean, you got to figure he's only been a Sith for a short time in comparison to his career and life as a Jedi. That, I think, is a really compelling idea when you're looking at the character of Dooku, that he's kind of maybe he's not a Sith in the sense of Darth Maul, who that's all he's ever known about the Force is the dark side.
His rage. Yeah.
Right.
And,
he brings
and
a totally
that's
different.
That's the thing I was about to say, is that I think Sidious and Dooku, and I mean, obviously they're simpatico in many ways with how they've chosen to align themselves with the Force, but they are two inherently different beasts when you break it down. And Dooku's, you know, his ruthlessness comes out of a social status and an upbringing. And the way I feel it, and it may be wrong, but I always felt like Palpatine, you know, whoever he was, it came out of a rougher upbringing. Real world experiences that let him down in the same way it did Ventress, in the same way the universe does Anakin. And I always felt like that's why Anakin was almost a better fit as an apprentice to Sidious than Dooku ever would be. Because they, to me, even though they've never really explained this, I feel like there's something congruent about the way they both had experiences in the universe, Anakin and Sidious, and Dooku is a completely different creature, you know, based on his upbringing and based on, you know, he was.
We know he's a Count. I mean, we know that there's
he's
a sense
a Count,
of,
and he's the greatest portion of his life. He's a Jedi,
right,
and he's
right.
Trained by very sympathetic teachers, and you know, he had incredibly wise students too, in the form of Qui-Gon. I'm sure your student teaches you as much as your previous master. I'm sure Qui-Gon was.
He's bookended by Yoda and Qui-Gon.
Two of the coolest Jedis probably ever.
Right.
And the thing about Dooku is he's a principled person, and he logics through things much more. Anakin's an emotional creature who emotes through things, and that's the way he experiences the Force. And I think that's, you know, Dooku's interpretation of it always felt to me like there was an intellectual side. Even in the way he fights the Night Sisters in the episode, you know, he approaches it in a far more tactical way than, say, Maul would, than I think Anakin ever would. And I think, of course, in the way Sidious ever would. Never really the only known Sith that we, you know, filmically seen in action. So he's a very different, even down to his fighting style. You know, he's attracted to a different type of, you know, highfalutin fencing. So
yeah,
it's
– right.
There are different subtleties in personality. I think that's why some Sith are better fit as apprentices, you know, for different people.
Hey, Paul, I noticed that he was pretty blunt. Dooku was pretty blunt when he was talking to Savage Press about overthrowing Sidious. And I don't recall, and I could be wrong, I don't recall there being a moment in the Clone Wars where we hear him have a similar conversation with Asajj. So we never see on screen that that is Dooku's intention until he has Savage Opress. I'm wondering, was that his goal with Asajj Ventress? Is it always the goal to overthrow the master and then keep the food chain going that way? Or was it that as soon as he had Savage Opress, he realized that he really had somebody that could really wreak some havoc on the universe?
Yeah, I'm confused in a good way about almost everybody's motives in these episodes, including obviously Palpatine's and Dooku's motives. So I think it's confusing, but I'm glad that it's confusing because it basically means that it's a really rich story and we're not quite sure what everybody's agendas are. So I don't think it's clear yet, Jason, and I'm not quite sure myself where I'd put that. I think it's still yet to be determined. So,
Jimmy, do you have any theories on why Dooku would be so blatant? I mean, he gets Savage Opress for presumably a couple of days, and he's already talking about overthrowing Sidious, and we never saw him have a conversation similar with Asajj Ventress.
Hey, sexist.
Well, why we're talking. Not? Yeah, right? I don't know.
I don't believe he felt that Asajj had the level of competence that he believed Savage potentially had. I think he just wanted muscle. And I think he thought Savage Opress was probably more capable of providing him with the backbone and the muscle and the strength that he needed to overthrow.
Was Opress more of just a blunt instrument? And whereas Asajj Ventress, maybe less capable physically, was more questioning, had upbringing, more less
a freak of nature. I mean, he's manipulated by Night Sister magic. He's not just like a raw specimen of, of a Zabrak / Iridonian, whatever he is.
Let's set the record straight. Darth Maul is a Zabrak born. I thought we were talking about Darth Maul, but it is confusing. He's a Zabrak born on Iridonia and raised on Dathomir.
Which makes sense because you have people born in different countries that are from different places, and you look at the Star Wars universe as a reflection of our world, and people can be a different nationality but born somewhere else and can emigrate places. And so I look at it really simply is like what fell into Dooku's hands now at the loss of Ventress. He sees the upside. I've got this gem. I've got this specimen now of a force creature, refined in they made him like a diamond to Dooku. Like, look what you found. Look what we've just given you. It's like he's not only powerful and from a bloodline of, people strong in the force, but he's also been manipulated in such a way. If you look at Darth Maul next to his brother, you're looking at 5'10" versus 7.5 feet tall. Bigger. I mean, he's just like a beast. And not only is he physically a beast, but he's been manipulated by magic. So he's dealing with something. The inherent traits of Savage are, as raw material, are far greater than, Ventress. And Ventress served her purpose as an assassin. But I think that's what he senses in here, but he doesn't see that that's like the trick is that it's too good, and that the plot is to turn on him because he is created powerful enough to turn on him. So he's assuming he can control it, but he doesn't know that there's a mind control element to this,
right,
quote unquote, perfect apprentice.
Right. What I was thinking was that here is an opportunity for Dooku to perhaps get somebody that was powerful enough physically to help him destroy Sidious, but also wasn't very bright.
Yeah. And
he's not going to necessarily be the typical Sith to try to overthrow him.
Right, right. He didn't pose the threat that Asajj did. He wasn't as much a loose wire as she is. And that's something that he can keep his thumb on, you know, and know what he's dealing with. Asajj was too unpredictable. And thus, she created a liability for him and his ultimate desire to overthrow Sidious and take over the universe. I think you're really onto something there, Jason, where he has something that he can mold and do exactly what he wanted.
And control.
And control. Yes. But then there were just too many variables in the end. And as you see happen, I mean, you know, jumping toward the end of the trilogy here, you see really for the first time, we see obvious example of why the rule of two is the rule of two, because you start getting three or more into the mix. They're all going to start turning on each other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It gets ugly. It gets very, very ugly. Jim, you mentioned the Gendi series where we first see Dooku training Grievous. And up until that point, the only real Jedi training that we've seen is Luke being trained on Dagobah with Yoda. Yeah. And what I found interesting is all the contrasts. I mean, if you contrast Yoda's training. Now, and as a kid, I felt like Yoda was kind of hard on Luke. I really did. I thought he was tough. Luke, he's reminding you one of those teachers, you know, that you loved, but they were tough. That ain't nothing like what Dooku is. I mean, the philosophy, the teaching philosophy is radically different.
Well, obviously when Dooku is training Savage, he's got him out there lifting those giant pylons, and much like Yoda had Luke lifting the stones. But when Savage fails, Dooku's very harsh with the Force Lightning, striking him down with that, trying to promote his hate and his anger and his pain and his fear, thus opening the door to dark side powers.
Yeah.
Whereas when Luke failed, Yoda was there with a philosophical speech. Yes, it was tough love to a certain degree, but it was still something that was soothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Life creates the Force. Luminous beings are we. It's all just a very soothing.
Well, and Yoda showed by example, no?
Yes, he did.
I mean, he didn't just talk it. He did it.
Well, you'll notice too that when Savage struggled lifting those big obelisk pylons, Dooku did demonstrate. Look, boom, and he did it too.
Yeah,
he lifted, and it was very similar. You know, only big in your mind,
right?
You know, only impossible in your mind. So don't let yourself be held back by the limitations of what you perceive as reality. But instead of using just natural abilities like Yoda tries to promote and opening your mind.
That's a good point. I mean, they almost have the same line, don't they? They really do.
And the parallels.
Yeah.
The parallels make sense because Dooku received his Jedi training from Yoda. He was Yoda's Padawan.
Right.
So what he's done is he's twisted and he's perverted the Jedi training into a method of Sith training. Whereas if you fail, you're feeling pain and you're going to feel hatred and fear and anger at your instructor, thus opening up the dark side of the Force.
Yeah, I mean, at one point he even screams to Dooku that he hates him. Kind of reminded me of Anakin yelling at Obi-Wan. And, you know, that's really interesting because we know that despite the brotherhood that we see between these two characters, that there is a deep-rooted hatred that Anakin has towards Obi-Wan. And we don't see evidence of it right now, but it's there. We see it in episode 2. We certainly see it in episode 3, so it's got to be there in between. And this notion of hating your master, it's almost, I mean, Dooku is almost saying in these episodes that's part of the Sith way. I need you to hate me. And that's where you'll find your power, isn't that ironic, because I think that's what we know is happening in Anakin, and it's kind of heartbreaking to think about.
Oh, you know, I hesitate to say that Anakin's path to the dark side is via a hatred for his master.
I think it's part of it. He's throwing things in episode two, and he tries to kill him in episode three.
Well,
connect the dots.
It's based in a frustration because Obi-Wan's holding him back, as Anakin says when he throws that.
It doesn't matter what it's based in. It doesn't matter what the reasoning is. He has a deep seated hatred toward Obi-Wan. You don't think so?
No, because I think that Anakin's path to the dark side has a basis. It's based in fear. It's based in the fear of losing Padme. It's based in the fear of losing his mother. It's not based in hatred. Hatred is a byproduct of Anakin's acceptance of the dark side. When Anakin accepts the dark side, then he accepts the hatred that comes with it. But what opens the door to Anakin becoming part of the dark side is fear. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
You didn't say it right. You have to go suffering.
All right. Somebody else weigh in here. Jimmy says no. I say yes. I say that a big part of Anakin's turn is this hatred towards his master. Kyle, is there hatred lurking under that in that heart of Anakin's?
I think there's hatred and there's distrust, and they hint at it. And I think obviously the novelization contextured far more than the film did, because it was all about a character portrait of Anakin versus, you know, an action film. But Anakin, there's a lot of resentment because Obi-Wan and the council forced him into a situation where he was a pawn. He did not want to be that. Everybody was dangling stuff and keeping it from him, too. His master access to secrets to keep his loved one alive and not explaining his visions properly, you know, helping him see through this stuff. And it's hinted at, and it's further, I think, in the novelization that Obi-Wan was a character, you know, he's like, Obi-Wan's been here. There's like that sense too that Obi-Wan, this distrust that he was moving in on, you know, in a way, Padme. I mean, it's subtle, but there's something there, and he's like shocked when he sees Padme with Obi-Wan on Mustafar. So that rage comes into it because he feels like Obi-Wan at that point has gotten to the person he loves and has changed her. He doesn't see that he's the element that's changed. He sees that Obi-Wan has manipulated the situation to his advantage and taken away the one he loved, to the point where he chokes her and has to fight him, because at that point he hates Obi-Wan, because in his distorted mind, Obi-Wan has manipulated the situation and he's trying to continue to do so with Anakin. And Anakin's going off a history of Obi-Wan manipulating him, because he asks him to spy on his friend. He asks him to do these things beyond his traditional Jedi obligations. And so Obi-Wan, in a sense, unbeknown to Obi-Wan, you know, actively, he's pushed him down this path. And Anakin, when he says, I hate you, it's an equal mix of, yes, frustration and hatred for Obi-Wan because of the situation he's now in, sitting there like he's, you know, floating in an ocean with no limbs, and also because it's hatred, it's a frustration with himself at that moment, because he knows in that moment everything that he could have been, he's let down the person he loves, and he's let down himself. So I think he projects it onto Obi-Wan, but it's also he does hate him at that point.
All right, well, we'll have to
tangential kind of opinion about that.
Yeah, please.
I actually think that maybe, especially being as the theme of this season seems to be secrets revealed, I think a new way of looking at this might be if we look back at Phantom Menace and Yoda's kind of saying we're not training him, he's not the right material for this. You could quite easily kind of blame Yoda for the way Anakin turns out, because even though we've not seen any of that, Yoda's initial reluctance and his lack of, you know, confidence in Anakin's ability to sort of turn into something that's Jedi material could actually have set the wheels in motion. I mean, if you actually look at a lot of Chinese mythologies, you know, quite often the greatest demons are created by the best warriors. And if you look at Star Wars, I mean, you can't kind of see a more polar character to Darth Vader than Yoda. So in some way, I could see it making perfect sense that Yoda's responsible for Darth Vader existing. I mean, if Yoda had taken a totally different approach and had been very kind of, you know, inclusive and encouraging and tried to help him, I mean, from every impression we've got from the movies is that Yoda just kind of totally said, I'm having nothing to do with this, this is not a good idea, and then just backed away from him. Whereas, you know, a lot of the other Jedi that are you know, really powerful and great Jedi, Yoda obviously played a massive part in their development. But from what we've seen so far, it seems as though Yoda had almost nothing to do with Anakin's development. It seems to me that, certainly from the movies anyway, that Yoda just backed away from him and said, you know, well, okay, but I'm having nothing to do with it. But whether or not, I mean, maybe the book presents that differently, but...
No, but, I think you're right.
That's
the
way, I mean, it seems to me. So I would blame Yoda more than his hatred for Ben.
Huh. Well, we'll have to, you know what, we'll have to come back and we'll have to do a roundtable on episode 3 where you can really...
Because Anakin
into...
in that moment, he's in that movie, he's a completely paranoid person.
Yeah, yeah, he is. I mean, what we're seeing in that movie is a total emotional breakdown. Is what we're seeing, and what's so exciting about the Clone Wars is that I think we're going to see what leads to this breakdown. I mean, Anakin, by the time you get to episode 3, even the beginning of episode 3, he's gaunt, he's got, the way they describe him in the novel is great, but you can even see some of that in the makeup that they have Hayden in Ep 3, is that he's kind of gaunt looking, his eyes are sort of sunken in, he looks tired. They even say, and it's kind of a lame piece of dialogue, but they even talk about him looking tired. And what you can read into that is that, you know, he's just undergoing an incredible amount of, and they talk about this, stress. You seem stressed. But what it is it's an emotional collapse, what you see in episode 3. And we're going to see the seeds of this in Clone Wars, and I actually think we're already seeing it. But let's get back to this. Let's get back to these episodes. We haven't really talked much about Mother Talzin and the Night Sisters Coven. It's an interesting group, part witch, part ninja. And I'll say this about Mother Talzin, and this took me a couple of viewings before I realized just how – well, she's a pretty smart cookie, this Mother Talzin. Why does she give Jimmy Mack? Why does she give her warriors, including Savage Opress on the, or excuse me, Asajj Ventress in their first attempt at Dooku's life? Why does she give them lightsabers?
Well, because she wants to throw Dooku off their scent. She wants Dooku to believe that the attack is being coordinated by the Jedi and not the Night Sisters. My question is, why does she give the Night Sisters a dart tainted with poison to dull Dooku's senses? Why not make the poison lethal and cut out the middleman?
I've got the answer for that. I thought about that, and it did bother me. But I think that Talzin knows that Ventress would not have wanted it that way. Ventress is a warrior. Ventress is a Sith. She wants Dooku to die by her own hands, by her own blade.
Right,
that's what she wants. It's about revenge. She wants that moment where she shoves that blade through his chest.
I think that the witches are working for the Emperor. I think if not, why must Dooku's death look like the Jedi did it? Why don't they just kill him? They've got to be working for the Emperor. It's the only reason why anybody would want him to die that way would be if the Emperor wanted it to look like it was the good guys killing him off, and it would be good for politics.
Whoa! This is heavy. Wait, you're saying that this supports collusion between Mother Talzin and Sidious, because otherwise they could just take him out without having to make it look like it was done at the hands of Jedi.
Yeah, I mean, who cares who killed him? You know, I mean, the only reason that they'd want it to look like Jedi is so they can use it
as propaganda.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a cool thought.
Yeah, because true. I mean, what difference does it make if their mission is to go kill Dooku? Who cares if the Night Sisters do it or the Jedi do it? In his mind, if he's dead, you know.
Well, I can think of someone who cares, Darth Sidious, because obviously, you don't want this guy coming down on you. You don't want to leave your fingerprints at the scene of the crime for killing, like, someone's right hand person.
But they don't. They don't know about Sidious, or do they?
Yeah, but you still don't want to walk in there. Still don't want to walk in there and leave your business card behind. You might as well pin it on somebody you don't like. I mean, it's just basic treachery.
What, it worked for the Wet Bandits, Kyle. Come on, you're a Home Alone.
Bandits, you're right. I mean, and this, it worked for the Sticky Bandits in the sequel. It'll be our calling card, man.
What something you guys don't know is that Kyle Newman actually went to a Home Alone party over the holidays.
Yes.
An actual Home Alone party.
Is one of the most amazing films. I love Home Alone. It's a holiday tradition. Yes, a friend had a Home Alone party, so we do love the Wet Bandits and Sticky Bandits.
That's awesome. But I think Paul's got a point.
I get Paul's point, but I do think, you know, as a basic function, you don't want to. You obviously, who's the only person probably powerful enough to best her master? You know, it'd probably be Ventress. So there could be that it could draw attention back to her. So you're covering, you're protecting her in a sense by not making it obvious it's Night Sisters or leaving it open to have been Ventress. If it's a death by force or lightsaber, you want to put that on, you know, draw the attention as far away as you can from Ventress. So,
Jimmy.
Yeah.
Mother Talzin. Mother Talzin reminds me a little bit of Mama Hutt. And that in this way, Mama Hutt, if you remember, she gives up Zero like immediately to the Jedi. So does Mother Talzin. She kind of plays coy at the beginning, and then she's like, "All right, hold on. Savage Opress." And she goes into the crystal ball thing, and she's like, "Oh yeah, he's on Tordaria." Very quickly, she gives him up. I mean, is it showing a confidence? Is it showing her confidence in Savage's ability to, you know, that Anakin and Obi-Wan are not really a threat? Hey, you want to find this guy? Go ahead. Go after him. Good luck. You know, have you seen him? He's like 7.5 feet tall. Or is it her own self-interest? She's got to protect the coven. She's got to protect the clan. And she doesn't want to go against the Jedi Order. She gives him up.
I think the latter is more true, Jason. I think she just didn't want to have any business with the Jedi, and it just wasn't worth debating or covering up for her. So she's going to cut her losses and just see what it was like to play both ends against the middle. And that, you know, that's a trait of the dark side right there. So I think that's probably more the case, but it is something that sort of stood out to me a little bit as like, you're going to go to all this trouble to present Dooku with an apprentice who is really a double agent, essentially, and then you're going to tell the Jedi where to find him.
I've got a big bombshell question about the witches, by the way.
Oh, all right, Paul, what's your bombshell question about the witches?
Well, first of all, I know when we were emailing back and forth about the witches, I made an observation about Dune fans out there will spot the connection between the witches resemble the Bene Gesserit from Dune, which basically is a group of witches who have very, very similar powers. You know, I mean, obviously they're all influenced by the same sort of mythologies and fairy tales, so there's nothing unexpected there. But they use a substance called melange to basically develop a power called the voice, which means that they can use their words to influence people like Obi-Wan does. But also the Reverend Mother of the Bene Gesserit is able to speak with the voice all the time. And I noticed that the top witch has that second voice in the background all the time.
Yeah.
Which to me really, really reminded me of that. And then the other connection was that they also use a thing called the Gom Jabbar, which is a poison needle that flies. And there you go. And then also they use a substance called the Water of Life they call it an illuminating poison, which is, again, wasn't it called the Water of Life?
It was. Absolutely.
So lots of similarities. But the thing that's missing out of that, and obviously a lot of this stuff is kind of inspired by various different mythologies, is that at some point in quite a number of mythologies, it's to do with that there are lots of stories where the witches are basically creating something or using their magic to create something. And when it comes to the Bene Gesserit, what they're trying to do is breed a more powerful magician than exists at their time by kind of using magic and breeding programs and stuff like that to kind of create an ultimate magician. And what occurred to me was, what if the witches had a hand in creating Anakin?
Hmm.
So it's a bit of a stretch, but
that's interesting. I just accept that, you know, I always take it as Plagueis, you know, began that force manipulation, and Sidious offed him and took up his science project. But I do think there is something interesting about, you know, the Dune reference, because I know that Lucas has said he was a fan of Dune. And Dune, there's so many similarities. I mean, you're talking about a desert Genesis planet that it's the center of everything that keeps popping up in that universe. And again, magic and, you know, the Bene Gesserit's like female-driven witch sorceress type order.
I mean, my main reason for going there was just purely because of them saying that this season is secrets revealed. I mean, and that is a very, very big secret that we don't know the answer to, isn't it? So,
well, and we certainly haven't seen the end of these guys. We have not seen the last of them. We know we got a 3-part arc coming up dealing with the origin of the Force. Nothing to do with Darth Maul or the Night Sisters. Or Savage Opress, any of that. And so I don't think they would have dropped the big Darth Maul bomb on us if they weren't going to follow up on it. So I think we'll see it probably later in the year.
I think that's something we're going to probably get. I think that's the kind of thing that they're going to promote this summer for next season. You know what I mean? It feels like...
To me, it feels like end of season 3 stuff, not opener
you're right.
of season 4.
I feel like it could be, because they always do something big for the end, and if not, I think it's going to be the visual push that they're going to use on everything in this summer to kind of push, you know, the season 4 and use it as Darth Maul returns, because that's a pretty big thing, and he's a very iconic character. So I could see them, from a marketing standpoint, hinging 4 on, you know, Maul's back.
Paul, what if the the ultimate powerful magician in this case, what you're talking about, is an Anakin. What if it's Maul?
Mm.
What if...
Or Savage.
Yeah, maybe Savage. Probably not, because we've already seen him. And and he's obviously not super powerful, because he's actually going after looking for somebody who's more powerful than he is. In the case, his brother... Darth Maul. So,
what's your theory here?
My theory is Paul's saying, okay, all these things line up, these correlations line up between the Night Sisters and the Dune, the witches from Dune. And he's saying, but generally, and in that case, they're all building, working up towards creating the ultimate magician, or there's someone that's all, you know, more powerful. And he was saying, well, maybe it's Anakin. I'm saying, what if it's Maul? What if what we don't know is that Maul, in his exile, we know he's been aided and abetted by the Night Sisters. They've been protecting his hiding. They've been protecting him. What if they're also educating him, and he's combining, you know, what if he's some sort of hybrid Sith / you know, witch? You know,
well, I would love for him to come back. Wait and see, I guess. But
yeah.
But you know, and I think it was too good a character to waste in one movie. I know, so I would be very happy if he returned in any sort of shape or form, even if it was flashbacks or something like that. But yeah, you could be right. I feel that we tend to be sort of very black and white about characters either live or die. You know, they're either kind of over with by the next movie or they're not. And I think it's quite important that they make sure that plenty of characters survive. I think that just because they're not, you know, they're not in the picture by episode 3, I think that shouldn't matter. I think there should be lots of characters that carry on, but they're just not part of the story anymore. So
right.
Here's what I think too. I would think it wouldn't be out of character now, from what we know about Maul's origin and from what we know about how they kind of shake things up with characters, to find out there was more to him than just pure physical warrior. That, you know, obviously his affiliation with Mother Talzin and stuff, maybe there is another dimension to him or something he's pursued since his accident in his time in exile. So maybe there is that dimension of like a witch, shaman, warlock type element to now his force arsenal. But I don't think they're going to go that way with him. I think if anything, what we're going to get in the next few episodes would be a confirmation that Anakin is of, you know, a virgin birth and force created, some type of anomaly. And that's why all these, you know, the father, the son and the daughter, whoever these new characters are pulled towards him. and this planet. So I think they're going to get some type of reveal like that. I don't know if they're going to say – I don't think they would go have like Mother Talzin do it. I mean, she obviously wasn't even powerful enough to keep a child from being taken by a quote-unquote criminal, let alone to – I think to, you know, create someplace as far off, you know, as wherever.
I didn't know that was the story, Cole. I hadn't read that.
Yeah, there's something in the Insider about that. But you know, I you never know. I mean, that's the thing. They do surprise us, and these are new characters, and we're learning about, you know, obviously all these people we thought we knew everything about. So who knows? And I think it's a good question to ask to keep us open to asking those types of things. But my opinion would be probably not. And I think we're going to find out, you know, just more about Anakin's true origin. Why other force powerful people in the universe? This new trilogy almost looks a touch Star Trek. Almost looks like a Genesis type planet.
Oh,
it almost looks biblical.
What I'm scared of is that, you know, Highlander 2, when they suddenly said like everybody's, you know, all these immortals are aliens, and it took the magic away. You know.
Well, we're gonna. I want to reserve a couple of minutes. I want to reserve a couple of minutes to talk about next week's episode.
Yeah.
And some speculation, sure. But we haven't talked about the biggest character, literally the biggest character of this whole arc. Really, is Savage Opress. We haven't really discussed him, and he's a you know, not unlike Savage Opress, or excuse me, Asajj Ventress. There's a lot of Ajahs tonight, a sympathetic character. And Jim, I remember you telling me after you saw this, you told me, you know, off the air, you're like, dude, when you see this, it's gonna blow your mind. I mean, there's this moment that just I keep playing it back in my head, and I think I know what moment you're talking about now. It's the moment when Savage kills Farrell. And tonight when I was rewatching the episodes, I thought the moment that Farrell's fate is sealed is the moment when Savage says to Asajj, please spare him, take me instead.
Yeah.
That's the moment.
There's some foreshadowing there. And it really gives a lot of weight to the Savage character. He's not just some random goon they picked out of nowhere who had no ties and no family and no life. He had a life, and he had people he cared about and loved, and his brother Farrell was one of them. So to kill off Farrell, the second he gets off the table after that transformation, it just tells you how much he's changed and how powerful that magic is that they used to change him, and how they've instilled such a level of evil, just an evil quality into him that didn't exist before. I mean, he would have given his life for Farrell. And so, but then
he almost did. He almost did a few times.
Right. And then the first thing he does when he gets off the table is he grabs him from around the throat, and in a very like Frankenstein, Incredible Hulk sort of way, weakling, and snaps his neck.
Yeah. He actually calls him, you begging weakling. I rewound it a couple of times to get that, what that first word was, you begging weakling, he says. And the Frankenstein comparison is true. But what I meant by, you know, sealing his fate is the moment that Ventress sees that there is an attachment,
yeah,
a connection, she, yeah, sees an opportunity.
Right. That's a recurring theme in Star Wars,
yeah,
where you find that weakness, and it usually, right, is your relationship, your attachment to another person. You see Palpatine exploit it with Anakin and his relationship with Padme. Even a step further, Force Unleashed 2, you see Darth Vader exploit Starkiller's attachment to Juno Eclipse. It's just something that keeps recurring in Star Wars. So here we see it happening again with the relationship between Savage and his brother Farrell. I thought that was very heavy. Yeah. I thought that scene added so much drama to the middle part of this trilogy. And it also made me wonder when I saw the screening, I said, oh God, this is such a powerful moment. I hope that Cartoon Network doesn't do something to soften the blow via editing. And I thought it was, you know, so heavy, I was wondering how kids were going to handle it. So I sat there and watched it with Dylan, who's 8 years old. And when that happened, I instantly looked at him because I thought, might have scared the pants off of him. he was able to handle it pretty well. But what it did illustrate to Dylan and what it illustrated to every viewer was this isn't the same guy that they took out of the village. The Night Sister's power was so evil that he turned on his brother.
You know, you're right. But there's a moment that comes later. And, you know, it's like I'm sure Dave Filoni and these guys, they just get the biggest kick out of us, you know, analyzing every word. But, Kyle, there is a moment when Dooku is giving Savage his first mission on Devaron. And he says,
there is a temple.
And he goes, a temple?
And he says, don't kid yourself.
There's a moment where you know, you realize that there might still be good in this guy because he's questioning Dooku sending him off to a temple, a holy place to wage war. This is after we see him snap the neck of his brother. So is there good in Savage?
Well, I think there's an imperfection to the magic. It doesn't feel like it's complete because obviously there's a point where he even turns on Ventress later in the show in part three after the abuse. You know, so there's obviously like a line that's drawn where he still retains a sense of self. So in that sense of self, I don't think he's been completely beaten down and desensitized. I think in that moment he kills Farrell. But I do think later I picked up on that too when he says a temple. Like it's just like he's still processing everything. He's almost like a newborn, you know, with far too many powers. So he's almost there's a naiveness to him. So I don't know if I would say
it wasn't compassion, it was naivete.
I don't think it's compassion. I think it's more naivete.
I think it's a level of intimidation. When he says a temple, he thinks, well, this place could be heavily guarded. I still don't have all the confidence in the world in my new abilities, and I'm intimidated by the power that Dooku is wielding. So he already knows that he is vulnerable.
Yeah, but doesn't Dooku say don't kid yourself, it's just a front?
Yes, because I think he's reacting to the fact it's a temple. He's not saying it's a fortress or, a battle station. He's saying it's a temple. And he's like, a temple? Like
it's a religious thing. Like, I'm going to go there and kill a bunch of priests? Or
a temple? You know,
yeah, a bunch of monks? A bunch of
BMR monks?
Way to keep it wars there, Kyle. Way to keep it wars. I love that. Pulling out the BMR monk.
You know, I think that's the thing. He's naive. He doesn't know the extent to how this war is. He's grown up on an isolated planet, so even who he was, he has a limited perspective of the universe. He's probably isolated from the war and the scope of it and the length of it and the depth of it. And I think at this point, he's just a pawn thrown into a big new world, and he reacts to it like a newborn in the Force. And that's the way I look at him. He's like a baby, you know? And he's somebody that's going to – once he matures – he's like a teen, you know, like he's in his terrible teens almost. Yeah. Once he matures and once the right person sinks their teeth into him, I think that was the attraction on Dooku's part, is here's a guy that if I wield my powers on him and manipulate him in a way where I control him and he's a perfect, assassin for me. He is the tool that will allow me to finally surmount Palpatine and take over. That's the attraction of him. But he is volatile. He is a child in his mind. And the people are doing a lot of those Hulk references. And he even talks like Hulk. I mean, it's pure. It's about strength and brute and aggression. And that's what also – that could be powerful. But if it's also under control. And that's why I think when Dooku sees what he's dragged back Katunko dead like a kid that kills an animal by mistake and doesn't even realize it. That's just like for Dooku, who's somebody who's so – refined and specific, and it's about language, and he's also a political leader. And here I am working. I'm forced to now work with this person who doesn't know the difference between alive and dead when I give you an order. Like, you are an imbecile. You know what I mean? It's got to be frustrating for him because, I mean, he thinks he's a brilliant guy, Dooku.
Right.
There he is. He's got to work with this person. So there's an element of frustration.
I mean, there's a point where Obi-Wan calls him reckless and impulsive, an animal, a monster. And I kind of thought that was a bit harsh, even though obviously he's all those things. I think that really, in a way, it depends on how you look at the character. I think the way I looked at him was that I saw him as an animal, but in a positive light. I saw him as a kind of like an innocent. I saw him as something who was reactive and acting on instinct rather than, you know, genuinely being a bad person. I mean, animals.
Yeah, he doesn't know any better.
Those kind of, yeah, I mean, I just kind of felt like, for me, he was like a wild animal in the house that kind of needed to be house trained.
You know, that's interesting because where else have we heard that in Star Wars? When Anakin first blatantly slipped to the dark side was when he attacked the Tusken Raiders, and he referred to them as animals, and he was giving into his hatred. So, I mean, could that be borderline slipping to the dark side via Obi-Wan with his same, you know, way of summing up Asajj as an animal?
Well, Obi-Wan also disses Jar Jar the first time he meets him. He's like, who's this dude? We're not taking him with us. He discredits him based on appearance. So Obi-Wan's never been predisposed to giving strange alien creatures the benefit of the doubt. He's always been a bit speciesist.
Yes, speciesist. That's true.
Something that occurred to me was, could it be that Savage isn't permanently transformed as well?
I was just thinking too.
Might he change back like Jekyll and Hyde or something? Or
like, what's the duration of the magic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if he wants to
be undone by
way.
Talzin with another potion, it's such a temporal thing. Like, how permanent is this? All you did was, like, put some, you know, magic neon green stuff on him.
You know, let's talk about that for a second, though. Let's talk about... you know, if you go to the episode guide, and we've talked, I think we've mentioned this before, that Star Wars and witches go back as far as the 1980s and, you know, the Ewoks cartoon. I'd argue not the finest hour of Star Wars, the Ewoks cartoon.
What was wrong with Sherall, please?
not its finest hour.
Joan Jett in a witch costume?
Yeah. How well does, I'll ask you, Paul, how well does the Star Wars universe, which is sci-fi fantasy, how well does it meld with another type of fantasy, the witch, the warlock, the potions, the spells? How well do the two mix?
I think they're one and the same. I think that fairy tales and, you know, I mean, you know, George, in the earliest interviews that you read in Starlog magazine and Starburst magazine in the UK and what have you, back in the 70s, George quite frequently would kind of say to people, this isn't science fiction, this is science fantasy. And I mean, where else do you find witches bitten fantasy books, you know? So for me, it just seems like one and the same. I don't really see them as being outside the Star Wars universe. In fact, for me, I just, you know, I completely took it for granted that there would be witches, whereas politics was an entirely different thing, where I just thought, you know, politics doesn't belong in fairy tales. But you know, for me, witches, it's just part and parcel of the genre. I think there should be witches in Star Wars, and I think, you know, it's just normal.
So, different understandings of the Force. Like, one of my questions is, how is it – what is her power? Is it drawn on the Force? Obviously Ventress has that in her, and she's one of them. It's in her blood, so maybe it's the Night Sisters. There is an inherent, you know, Force, or how much of it is magic, of it some other type of power in the universe that isn't directly correlated to Force that they're drawing upon? Or is this just a manifestation of the Force in the form of magic? You know what I mean? Is it something separate?
I wondered that too, Kyle, because in my mind,
but Ventress is powerful.
When I think about the galaxy far, far away, I think of the Force as the underlying principle of everything, and that there couldn't be something, you know, like the concept of multiple gods or one god. That I remember actually seeing a quote from George Lucas when they asked him point blank one point about religion. He says, "I think we're all seeing different parts of the same elephant." And so in the Star Wars universe, I think it's a monotheistic universe. I don't know. Why would there be the Force and then something else?
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's monotheistic.
Well, maybe I'm not using the right term. But what well,
put it this way, like Buddhism isn't monotheistic, and it's as near to Buddhism as it is to monotheist belief. So,
all right, well, maybe that's not the right term. What I'm talking about is the underlying principle of all is the force. So it's hard for me to believe that there's the force and there's magic.
Right. Yeah.
That magic must be some sort of manipulation of the force or have something to do with the force. I guess that's the way I see it too, Jason.
I think you're right.
Yeah. So it raises all kinds of questions. Getting back to Savage Opress, one of the things that we see on display is sheer brute strength versus Jedi power. And Jedi Halsey and Nox, who are the red shirts for this particular episode, get wasted very quickly. I mean, he lands on that planet. He lands on Devaron, and he just runs like a tank. He's knocking over battle droids, Jimmy. He's knocking over super battle droids. He gets to those two Jedi, and he makes very quick work of them. And he hasn't even really had a whole lot of training. He's not even wielding a lightsaber at that point. So I started to wonder, wow, the Force is no match for just sheer brutality?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're just some things that, you know, I mean, I guess it would depend on the level of their mastery of the Force. And as we've learned, not everyone in the Jedi Temple has the sort of mastery of the Force that Anakin, Yoda, and Obi-Wan have. So that they get exiled out to Devaron to go hang out at some temple. waiting for the hammer to come down.
Nothing's going to happen here. I mean, you know, it's pretty boring here at the Temple of Devaron.
Yeah, not exactly the most strategic spot in the galaxy, but a good place to break in your neutral destruction.
That's the scene we need in the expanded edition, isn't it, where they're just sitting around kind of going, gee, nothing ever happened. What? Who's that? Run!
I want to see that.
It's great that I woke up here. Where's my lucky rabbit's foot? That's the movie cliche, isn't it?
Oh, of course, exactly. Or, you know, the poor soldier sitting around like, boy, when I get back home, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go get myself a coney from, you know, whatever. And then, bang, he's dead.
But let's be honest, those were also two throwaway Jedis he faced.
Yeah, but is there such a thing, and should there be? We're not talking about clones, we're talking about Jedi.
About 700 throwaway Jedis at the Battle of Geonosis. It's like, let's create a bunch of human-looking weirdos in the arena to get their asses.
What were the names, like Fodder and...
It's like, let's just put the technical staff as Jedis with mullets and kill them.
Well, let's not forget I'm a Gundai.
He just had a very different fighting style, the first Jedi that he fights, that was obviously not a good match for fighting somebody. Look at him. At the end of this episode, he comes out into the hangar after he's fought with Obi-Wan and Anakin, and they unload. We're talking super battle droids, weren't the destroyers unloading on him, and he just takes it in the chest, and then he does a
star. Yeah, he's like Kong.
And part of it might be his armor. I don't know if the armor was also...
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that that's part of
with
it.
With special magical... He has a strange weapon that he uses that they gave him too, that staff. But
right.
Maybe it's imbued with some magic too that also gives him defense. I look at it like Dungeons & Dragons when you get, you know, your armor.
Well, look at all the force lightning he was able to withstand. We had a listener on Facebook counted all the force lightning bolts, and it was 11. 11 times he was hit by force lightning.
And he didn't get a cauliflower face.
But I mean, you have to figure that Dooku can control the intensity of that.
Sure, right. That's true.
He could stun you, or he could make it lethal.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you get that sense in Jedi where Palpatine is just playing with Luke for a while. And then finally he's had enough, and he's like, and now, young Skywalker, you will die. And that's it.
And he's also in the Vader absorbing blaster bolts. Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, but that kills. But that kills Vader off.
Turned it into like a rave ball, and then you have a Jedi in the Old Republic trailer. Basically, like they absorb the lightsaber in their hand and they serve it up for dinner.
Well, all right.
Like, okay. Oh, whatever.
Do you know? I really don't know what your problem is with that. You know, considering we didn't know that. The Jedi could run like Roadrunner until Phantom Menace, you know, and then like we just moved the goalposts.
But that's so, like, always been something that George has said. You never saw Jedi at their full potential. We saw one who was a fragment of himself, was a robot, and we saw another one who was an old man who was kind of.
I also have my own personal philosophy about the Force and Jedi powers is that you can't define it. I feel like the Force works in ways that are mysterious and applicable to the situation, that it's not necessarily just, okay, the Force gives me the ability to do this, you know, this trick, that trick, this trick. It is fluid and allows you to, when you call on it, if you're good at wielding it and utilizing it, and it gives you the tool, it gives you the ability that you need in that situation.
You could look at it like a martial art too, couldn't you? In that, you know, some people are going to be good at kicks, other people are going to be good at something entirely different.
There you go.
Know?
That's a completely other thought. Yeah, absolutely.
Just be about your skill level.
Exactly.
What you're good at.
Exactly. I want to talk about continuing our discussion here about Savage Opress. It's kind of cool that he wields the double-bladed lightsaber. I thought that was great. I mean, it's. They, you know, that was an image that they desperately wanted when they were dealing with a Zabrak, you know, Sith. We got to give him the double bladed lightsaber. But who was it that was talking? I think Jimmy, you were mentioning, or maybe Kyle was mentioning the killing of Katunko, and it's actually pretty brutal the way he throws him like a dead duck into that ship, and the body kind of bounces. And I don't feel like he didn't know what he was doing. I think he was in full control of his faculties, and I don't think he accidentally snapped his neck. I went back and watched it and rewound it a couple of times. It looks very deliberate to me. It doesn't look like a, oh, crap, Lenny petting the kitty and the kitty dies, you know. Kind of thing. It looked deliberate to me, and I'm trying to figure out why. I don't think it was an accident.
Well, I think it was a move based in panic. He was afraid. His main objective was to go there, get Katunko, and bring him back to Dooku. He saw a situation where he was being held back by the Jedi. He was, you know, exerting all of his effort to fighting them, and then he sees Katunko going to escape. So you're dealing with a situation where Savage is learning about his new powers, and he probably doesn't realize how strong he actually is at this point. He can't really control it. So maybe, you know, just like a little, you know, trying to hold him back turned into a lethal choke. And then, you know, the damage was done. So
I think it was the Force equivalent of Lenny petting the kitty.
Yeah, I did
you
like
do?
That. I did like that comparison you made, Jason. It seemed apt.
Huh.
Or it could just be simple maths too, couldn't it? Because he could be thinking, how badly can I fail at this? Can he completely get away? You know, that's one thing.
He's overwhelmed by these guys. He's trying to survive two guys. It's his first time really fighting, like, competent, you know, formidable Jedi team, probably the best Jedi team in the galaxy.
Wait a minute. What about Halsey and Knox? What about those guys?
So again, it was his first time fighting, like, a really – like, look, that's a master and a Padawan. You're looking at these two when they roll into town. They're, like, the two most powerful Jedi team you can send out on a mission.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's not a guy who pays attention to details, I don't think, Savage. Yeah. He's just, like – it happened, and he doesn't think that he's going to let his guy down. He's like, look, I got out of there. I did kind of what you wanted. Is this good enough?
Hey, Kyle,
that's
since
like
you
– Frankenstein would do it.
Since you call Savage Savage, do you call Asajj Assage?
Wait, say that again?
Well, if you call Savage Savage, do you also call Asajj Assage?
I call him Fred Savage Oppressed.
Fred Savage. Well, listen, Kyle, you can call him Savage, but please.
And he hangs out in Savage's garden.
Please, you can call him Savage, but please do not call him Macho Man.
No, Savage Oppressed. It's just too similar to Assage.
I know, it's hard. Like, believe me, it's hard.
There is an overlap there.
Much of an overlap. Hey, I want to talk about this magic, Paul. We were talking about magic earlier, and there I drew some comparisons between the brainwashing of Savage, and then all of a sudden Assage. All right, I'm going to take Kyle's advice here. The brainwashing of Savage, so that all Assage had to do was go over and like touch his forehead, and all of a sudden it was like, to me, execute Order 66.
Mm.
And I think that it was the second time we've seen this programming, this ability to program someone. Actually, I kind of felt that there was a lot of comparisons between Savage Oppress and the clones, bred for a certain thing, programmed, really very little regard for him as an individual just a total pawn. You think that this is like, can we draw comparisons, and is this a representative in a way of what the clones are going through or what they're about to go through?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, that whole kind of mystical kind of pressure point thing I thought was very cool. And the idea that, you know, they could just kind of trigger him like a sleeper agent or something was very, very similar to the Order 66 sort of situation as it turns out, wasn't it? So, I mean, it seems to me as though, you know, although Grievous is commonly the one that's spoken about as though he's the old-fashioned kind of silent movie villain who, you know, kind of twizzles his moustache and runs away at the first sign of a fair competition, I still think that there's a lot of fighting going on here at arm's length. I mean, there's all kinds of characters that are just sending somebody to go and do their business. So, yeah, I mean, it's nothing new, is it, in that respect? I think it's very like Order 66.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, you almost have to. Even in the latest modern warfare, it's like you send someone else to do your business. We're not sending out our president to go fight, the Taliban.
Oh, no, that doesn't make sense.
It makes sense. So I get that. But I also, you know, one thing I wanted to draw attention to, which I thought was great while we're on the topic of that, is the sound design that accompanied it. I thought that was awesome. I really think they did amazing stuff with the sounds of Night Sister magic, kicking in and out of that control. And I also really loved Talzin's voice, the way it had this that extra almost male demon voice layered behind it.
Yeah, you know, earlier or later, depending on when you're listening to this, you'll hear on the Forcecast for this week, Jimmy and I talk about an interview that the voice actress did. Her name's escaping me, Jim. What's her name that did Mother Talzin?
Maria Uspenskaya.
No, the one that did Mother Talzin, not the one she based
Barbara Goodson?
Barbara Goodson, yeah, Barbara Goodson. She talks about that effect that they use, and she said that she thought it made sense because Mother Talzin, and apparently this is the background, the backstory that she got from presumably Dave Filoni or somebody like that, that she's very, very old. She's been around for hundreds, thousands, millions, whatever, of years, and that that other voice is not just one voice, but it's a collection of voices of souls that are with her. Jim, do you remember what I'm talking about?
Back to the Bene Gesserit again, because they have a connection with all their previous incarnations, don't they? Like the daughter. Sorry, we're back to Dune. So the witches in Dune, basically the last daughter has a like a kind of a race memory of all her previous, like her mother, her grandmother, and every mother in her family, right back till the start of her lineage. So there's a bit of that. There's more Dune popping up.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very cool. She said, I thought it was a pretty cool choice. If I'm a person who's been around for, I'm basically immortal, right? I guess my voice might have a lot of reverb. I'm channeling ancient energies, so they're all in me, kind of like The Exorcist, which I auditioned for in my early 20s. So that kind of a thing. And she said that, you know, she kind of borrowed from her experience auditioning for The Exorcist, and the girl who got the role, the double for Linda Blair, as well as the what Jimmy was saying, the Maria Uspenskaya, which is that sort of stereotypical Transylvanian or Romanian voiced actress from the 40s. So, yeah, I mean, so much thought goes into the design. Kyle, you're right to point that out. It was great sound design work on behalf of these guys putting together this character. It really fleshed her out and made her so ominous.
And the Night Sister crossbow I thought was a great visual addition. That cool lavender almost reminded me of the Dungeons & Dragons animated series when you kind of like you pull back this invisible blade and there's like a magic energy there.
Yeah, that was good.
Visually was cool.
That was very cool. I mean, when we talk about the visuals, I mean, I think I would have to say that the Anakin Obi Ventress lightsaber battle at the top of the first episode is the best lightsaber battle so far I've seen in the Clone Wars. I
preferred it to any fight in Revenge of the Sith.
It was unbelievable. I rewatched all these episodes before we recorded tonight, and I rewound that a couple of times just to watch it. The lighting's amazing. It just was phenomenal. You compare it to later in the episodes where we've got the battle between the three. We've got Asajj and the other two warrior Night Sisters versus Dooku. That battle didn't really work for me. There were multiple times I thought, and I know this is being nitpicky, but there were multiple times where the other two were just standing there, and they could have totally taken Dooku out. And believe me, I'm a big James Bond fan, so I know what it's like to watch your hero fight 20 people, you know, and it can be hokey, but there's a way to shoot it so it's not quite so hokey, and there were these pregnant pauses in the battle.
In Revenge of the Sith, you know, we have these tennis moves where they're just literally spinning sabers for 10 minutes.
I want to comment on that battle with the Night Sisters versus Dooku. What you're dealing with here is, and I watched this very closely, because lightsabers cannot just be handed to someone and they all of a sudden know how to use them. If you notice, the only person who was putting together combinations of moves during that battle with Dooku was Asajj Ventress, the only one who actually has experience in training with a lightsaber. The other two Night Sisters would just get off like a quick shot and back off because they didn't have the knowledge. They couldn't parry. They couldn't, you know, duel in a proper fashion because they were not properly trained on how to use a lightsaber. They could just, you know, poke and stab and swipe real quick, and they'd have to pull off and wait for their next moment to find their end to do it again and then pull off. They couldn't put together multiple moves. They couldn't put together a combination of moves because they didn't have the experience, especially against someone who is at such an expert level of dueling as Count Dooku.
Yeah. Mm. No, I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair.
Really apropos on how they portrayed that.
I hadn't thought of that.
I actually thought one of my favorite fights in the whole trilogy was when Asajj was fighting Savage, you know, just the hand-to-hand stuff. Because it was such a mad combination of, like, ninjutsu and Wing Chun and, you know, all kinds of things thrown into the mix.
You're talking about the challenge on Dathomir.
Yeah, the initial
Dathomir.
Challenge. Yeah. She was so about, like, the center line. She was just, like, really relentless and just... You know, there's no way he was going to beat her. You know, it's just that was a great fight.
There were there were a lot of incredible things in these episodes that we saw. I mean, the sequence I thought when Obi-Wan and Anakin first arrive on the scene in the space battle was very reminiscent to me of Episode 3, where you have the real long continuous shots and they end up in the hangar and they have the battle to the point where you see R2 pop out of the ship and.
That whole opening battle was incredible. I mean, even the, you know, Asajj's fighter, that when you look really close at the wings, they were kind of really gossamer, you know, just incredible. And then the way they'd redesigned the interior of her, what do they call it? Is it a fan blade or something? A fan? can't remember the name of the ship.
But Slingblade.
Fanblade, that's it. And inside, her seat was designed so it looked like she had horns when she was sitting down in it.
Oh, cool. I didn't notice that. I noticed the glowing eyes of the Zabrak during that second challenge was
Like wolves.
Awesome. Yeah, awesome. I thought the invisibility effect, for the battle, I thought was just rendered so well. And the Republic Commandos, all right, for all you big Karen Travis fans out there, you got your Republic Commandos. It was cool. And
Rain. Brilliant Rain.
Yeah, right. And you know, them carrying the caskets down, you know, of course, according to Kyle, they were very lame Jedi, but still, it was cool to see those caskets.
I liked those Jedi. was that Stacy Tin? Who was that?
No.
So that was his first appearance, wasn't it?
No. This was Knox. This was Knox.
I'm talking about when the Republic Commandos arrived.
Yeah, that they're bringing the bodies of the slain Jedi in the caskets.
Those Jedis. Who was up in terms of council members to get the news?
That's right. Yeah, it was the first appearance of
Stacy Tin.
Yeah, that was cool. I forgot about that. The final battle between Ventress, Dooku, Savage, Anakin, Obi-Wan, it totally, for me, had a Force Unleashed kind of vibe to it. I mean, there was some extreme, you know, and I liked it. I really did like it. It didn't bother me at all. So it's actually a compliment when I'm saying this. But there was some stuff that we hadn't really seen before. I mean, Kyle, you kind of alluded to this earlier when Savage takes out, you know, all of the battle droids. In the one moment, and there's another moment where he's talk about super chokehold. He's got de-bests Dooku and Asajj, and he's got them at his mercy. Was that not something you were digging? I mean, that kind of unleashed sort of style.
I liked it there because it was like such an extreme survival situation. It wasn't like casually, like it happens every 3 minutes. I feel like you know what it felt like to me? That it was also within Anakin's wheelhouse to have that kind of power if he was unhindered and in sufficient rage to kind of tap into it. Like, you know, and an oppressed in that moment is just been let down on, he's beaten up, he's let down, and is just an animal backed into a corner lashing out. And that's what I felt like that moment was. You know, the animal that's cornered, that has nothing to do but claw its way out, and that animal does it with, you know, it's the Force as its claws. So it was a real survival outleashing of the Force there. So it didn't bother me at all. It wasn't like he's walking down a corridor and he points at somebody and they explode, and he points over there and someone else explodes. You know, like in the Force Unleashed, where it's just like, you know.
Yeah, but it was kind of an extreme take on the Force that we hadn't seen in any of the films or in the Clone Wars up to this point.
But I think that's to substantiate the point that Savage is such an extreme and new variable in the dynamics of the Clone Wars, that he is something that has been, you know, we might find that Sidious actually covets him for a little bit as a potential instead of Anakin. Who knows where it's going to go? But obviously, he was enough to catch the eye of Dooku. In fact, Dooku felt like, I can finally make my move now. We know that he senses this power. And there we see it validates what Dooku sensed, was that here is a creature that, if harnessed, is incredibly scary and powerful.
Yeah. Well,
gotta say, I think, you know, being as nobody's mentioned it, I really like Clancy Brown's voice as well. I thought it was fantastic.
Oh yeah,
I mean, obviously, awesome. I'm a Highlander fan anyway, so I liked him as the Kurgan, but it could have been very, very one dimensional, couldn't it? But it managed to kind of keep that sympathetic edge and at the same time be terrifying. So
yeah, great indeed. Now, what would any major Clone Wars episode involving or episodes involving Asajj Ventress B without some commentary from our good friend, Sonny from New Orleans.
Hello, Forcecast. Sonny from New Orleans here. Wow. Star Wars is back and strong. Ventress is back, and not a moment too soon. What can I say? She looks just incredible. In fact, little did I know at the time, but the Forcecast microphone was down in the Big Easy and was recording while I was watching the Friday night episode. He, in fact, here is a little clip of what was captured on tape.
Whoa, that was cool.
So you get the idea. I just melted and turned into an adolescent mess for the whole first viewing. Now, what many people are also not aware of is that Christopher Lee has gone back to the studios to record music. Yes, he was inspired by the events in Friday's episode and recorded a song about Ventress. Once again, the Forcecast mics were there. And we have an exclusive clip from that song about Ventress.
That girl is
poison. You never trust a big button to smile.
She's dangerous.
Sounds like Ventress has an unofficial theme song. It's perfect. Now, as far as the show went, the episode, the plot was perfect. Great job, Katie Lucas. No plot holes that took me out of the story. As far as EU backstory, I didn't know anything about it before, but what was presented on screen was absolutely rich with character texture and complexity. Perfect job. I cannot wait for the rest of the season. Finally, I gotta mention the final walk. The second time we are gifted with the runway walk of Asajj Ventress. Hats off to Katie Lucas or whoever designed the native outfit that Ventress is wearing at the end. Hello, what have we here? Hip boots. Hip boots and a miniskirt. It just doesn't get better than that. Welcome back, Star Wars.
All right, that's going to wrap up our look at the Night Sisters trilogy. Three, in my opinion, phenomenal episodes, quite possibly the best we've seen so far this season. And I would say it may rank up there with the best we've seen in the series so far as a whole. Really great work from everybody, from the new character models to, like Sonny pointed out, a wonderful trilogy of episodes with little to no plot holes, nothing that really pulled me out of it. Really, very little to complain about. Kyle, I know you got to be heading out here. Your final thoughts on these episodes?
I was excited before I got to see them. Seeing them as a whole, I was blown away. I was granted a cinematic, big screen Star Wars experience. And I think that'll always stick in my mind as a very special way of viewing the Clone Wars. And they worked as a big whole, and it's all under, I think, Dave's stewardship that he can, kind of take all these different, creative forces and pull them together and tell such a story with scope and power. And I think Katie's script was, for the three parts, was great. And so far she's written some of my favorite Star Wars episodes in the past. In this whole season. And I just thought it gave new depth to the dark side. We've got some great new villains, and we've textured villains that we thought we knew everything about. So I was mesmerized by that, and I think now my appetite is wet because we've got Darth Maul dangled in front of us. Is it him? And if so, what incarnation of him are we going to get? So there's more questions asked. So while we get our secrets revealed, we're also getting new questions that need to be answered. So I was just thoroughly impressed by these, and I enjoyed every second of it. And I will say, kudos to everyone involved, because that's just great Star Wars right there. And Ben Quadraneros was not in this episode, but he will be soon. He will be soon. May the Force cast be with you.
All right, man. Thanks so much. Kyle Newman, you can follow him on Twitter at Kyle_Newman. He's also available on Facebook, so reach out and like him or fan him or whatever it is you crazy kids do on Facebook. Paul Bateman, Lots of eye candy in this episode.
Oh,
and these episodes,
amazing episodes. And if these three episodes are anything to go by, I hope Katie writes the rest of them till we get to season 10. and even though I spotted a lot of stuff that was kind of felt familiar in, you know, mythological themes that I feel like I've seen before, there was a freshness and an originality to this trilogy that just kind of really, really rocked my world. I thought it was fantastic, and I think the writing can't be improved upon. For a 20-minute show, I think the amount, the scope and the impact of these episodes is just unbelievable. I think that Obi and Annie look fantastic with the great new models. I think that they're more expressive, and I care about them much more, and I realise that a lot of that's down to the animators and the way it's written and what have you, but I also think the new look helps. My only comment would be, I think that now it's time for a new improved Yoda model, because I think that he was the one thing that kind of stood out as being exactly the same as he seemed to be right back at the start. So I think it'd be nice to have a similar improvement for Yoda. But bottom line is, Katie's an amazing writer. Looks like the series is in good hands all round, what with Dave being the head honcho and writers of that calibre. So more.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul. You can also check Paul out at RalphMacQuarrie.com. He's also available on Twitter at PaulRMQ. That's PaulRMQ. Jimmy Mac, I know you've been thinking long and hard about these episodes over the last 3 weeks, knowing we'd be here. And this moment, final thoughts, go.
All right, Jason, final thoughts on the Night Sisters trilogy. Wow, what an amazing ride these three episodes provided us Star Wars fans. So much action, so many lightsaber battles, the birth of a new, instantly iconic villain, Savage Opress, and foreshadowing the return of a fan favorite, Darth Maul. Let's start with the characters. The enigmatic separatist leader, Count Dooku, was finally revealed in his full Sith glory. I love the sequences of Dooku training Savage. I love the way Dooku took Yoda's methods of training Jedi as seen in Empire, yet twisted it to meet his own evil ends. I thought the Night Sisters were amazing, especially Mother Talzin. I love the way David Accord gave her an evil resonance in her voice as it echoed around the environment of Dathomir. As for the planet Dathomir itself, sorry, EU purists, but this incarnation of the planet is far more interesting and appealing to me than the jungle planet rife with rancors as presented in novels like The Courtship of Princess Leia, which is a book I do enjoy, by the way. I love those weird eye droplet pods that dominated the red surface of the planet, and I really enjoyed the ramshackle village the warrior Night Brother tribe inhabited. The competition among the Night Brothers to win the spot aside Asajj was so well choreographed and executed that it brought me to the edge of my seat. The drama of placing Savage's loyal brother Farrell in imminent danger was also so well played, as was his death at the hand of the transformed evil Savage. The lightsaber battles throughout this trilogy were ample and exciting. The repartee between Anakin and Obi-Wan was wonderful and very consistent with the films, while adding a fresh wrinkle to their friendship. And the finale, featuring Sith against Sith against Sith, was very compelling, as was the amazing twist at the end. I look forward to seeing the return of Darth Maul to the Star Wars universe, as well as the return of Savage and the Night Sisters. I hope this trilogy will become available edited together as one show like we saw at the screenings in December, because I believe that is the best way to experience this storyline. We have seen the future of the Clone Wars, and the future is bright. Or maybe I should say the future is dark. Very dark. And I say bring it on. Nuke Gunray, not in this episode.
All right, we'll be back next week with a look at the first of three new episodes, Overlords, a new three-part episode arc. Big things in store, the origin of the Force, the identity of the Chosen One, the future of Ahsoka. As Jimmy Mack said, bring it on, and we'll be bringing it on next week. We'll have it all for you here on the Clone Wars Roundtable. Love you guys so much. We'll see you next time. For Kyle Newman, Paul Bateman, I'm Jason.
And I'm Jimmy Mac.
And remember,
the Force will be with you always. This podcast is not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited or 20th Century Fox and is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The official Star Wars site can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names and sounds of Star Wars characters, vehicles, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Lucasfilm Limited or their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of the Force.net LLC unless otherwise indicated.